This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Grost. Lyricist Jerry Lieber died Monday in Los Angeles. He was 78. He and his partner Mike Stoller wrote some of the most memorable rock and roll songs of the 50s and 60s.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one.
Say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
I took my troubles down to Madame Ruth. You know that gypsy with the gold cap tooth. She's got a pad on 34th and Vine, selling little bottles of love potion number 9.
What I say? Whoa, 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 Ruby, Ruby, how I want you now, like a ghost, I'm gonna haunt you now. Ruby, 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 will you be mine sometime?
Everybody always picking on me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me.
Lieber and Stoller wrote for Elvis Presley, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. They not only wrote songs, they often produced them. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on a record for their work. One of rock's greatest producers, Phil Spector, got his start as one of Lieber and Stoller's assistants. Lieber and Stoller met in L.A. when Lieber was still in high school, and they were soon writing songs professionally. Lieber was the lyrics half of the team, and he was known for sassy phrases that captured the vernacular spoken by young people of his day. Terry spoke to Lieber and Stoller in 1991. They began by listening to the original 1953 version of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them. And she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big. And she must have weighed about, oh, anywhere from 275 to 350. And she had this really gutty, guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her. And we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain. And we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and what
right.
you came up with hound dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it, it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas. Now, I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it, but it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay. Did you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly, that's all.
Yeah. Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that?
One threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing. Let it rock. Everybody let it rock. Everybody in old cell block.
Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal and True, you know, songs where he was supposedly graduating high school, but we had to write these terrible songs. The problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs, and this is Charlie Brown.
V-V-5-5-4-4-4. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me. That's him on his
knees. I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black, and because you see, when I was a kid growing up, it was where I came from, it was hip to be black, you know. I mean, to be white was kind of square, you know, and the clothes, you know, you had to dress a certain way, and if you looked a certain way and you spoke a certain way, then you were okay, and if you didn't, then you were lame. And all, you know, teenagers especially are very, very conscious about what is hip and what is lame and what is square and what is out and what is in, you know? And, I mean, I grew up right there in the middle of a black culture, and I knew dead on what it was, you know? I mean, firsthand.
And I belonged to a social club in Harlem from the time I was 13 years old, and I used to go up there every weekend. And from there, of course, I used to hang out on 52nd Street and listen to all the jazz musicians in the little clubs. So that was a part of my life.
When I met Stoller, he was sporting a goatee and he was wearing a beret, and he would stand hunched over like he had a humpback, and he'd smoking, and he would say, "Mmm." You say anything to him. You say, "You want to go to the movies?" He'd say, "Mmm." Or you say, "You hungry, man? Let's go eat." He'd go, "Mmm." Because he was like that, right? It wasn't until he was about 21 that he started talking.
So let me ask you again if there was a point when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black.
I think when Baraka turned to me one day, because Leroy Jones had been my buddy for years, and Leroy in New York told me that I was the greatest living black songwriter. This was when he was Leroy Jones. And about 2 or 3 years later, when the revolution started to happen, right, he informed me that I was white.
How did you respond?
I sort of felt like I'd been betrayed.
I think he was astonished to find out.
I started sitting in the front of the bus.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll, or to rhythm and
blues.
That
was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this.
Jerry heard it and he said, "That sounds like strings." And I said, "Why not?" And so, why not? We We had five violins and one cello. And they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano. And they had a small Brazilian group, and the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody. And I just loved the rhythm on it, and we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date, and there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio, and we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp, so he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. And it was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
My guests are the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. What is your style of working together? Let me go back to when you were writing hits nearly every day. What was your style of working together? Would you be in the same room?
We'd be in the same bathrobes. We were matching bathrobes. Yeah, we'd be in the same room. Actually, Stoller would normally sit at the piano. And I would sort of stalk around the room and smoke. Now, neither of us smoke anymore, so it's taken half the fun out of work. But he would sit at the piano and fiddle. And finally, I don't mean fiddle. I mean fiddle with a piano, you fool.
And Lieber would stalk around the room screaming.
Right.
And if something stuck to the wall, something he screamed, we work on it.
We take a biopsy and work. But now that was the early days. The way we work these days, when we work, I usually have a fix on a lyric, and I'll bring in 8 or 10 or 12 lines, and I'll give it to Mike, and he'll go home and work on it, because this way we can have some time alone.
And it's is a delight. Or I will write a melody or half a melody and lay it on Jerry and say, listen, what can you do with this? And then we'll get back together and tear it apart and start over.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Righto, yeah, it was fun.
Songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Lieber died Monday at the age of 78. Here's On Broadway, a record which Lieber and Stoller produced and co-wrote with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
They say the neon lights are bright on.